disputes in southern Russia, gave it first claim to transportation facilities, made it difficult for the SS to obtain the necessary trains to carry out the final resettlement. Also, Stroop reported, the Jews were resisting their final liquidation in every possible way. It was not until spring that Himmler's order could be carried out. It was decided to clear out the ghetto in a special action lasting 3 days. As it turned out, it took 4 weeks. The deportation of more than 300,000 Jews had enabled the Germans to reduce the size of the walled-in ghetto, and as SS General Stroop turned his tanks, artillery, flamethrowers, and dynamite squads on it on the morning of April 19, 1943, it comprised an area measuring only 1,000 by 300 yards. It was honeycombed, though, with sewers, vaults, and cellars which the desperate Jews had converted into fortified points. Their arms were few. Some pistols and rifles, a dozen or two machine guns that had been smuggled in, and homemade grenades. But they were now, on that April morning, determined to use them, the first time and the last in the history of the Third Reich that the Jews resisted their Nazi oppressors with arms. Stroop had 2,090 men, about half of them regular army or Waffen-SS troops, and the rest SS police, reinforced by 335 Lithuanian militia and some Polish police and firemen. They ran into unexpected resistance the first day. Hardly had operation begun, Stroop reported in the first of his many teletyped daily reports, than we ran into strong concerted fire by the Jews and bandits. The tank and two armored cars pelted with Molotov cocktails. Owing to this enemy counterattack, we had to withdraw. The German attack was renewed, but found heavy going. About 17:30 hours, we encountered very strong resistance from one block of buildings, including machine gun fire. A special raiding party defeated the enemy but could not catch the resistors. The Jews and criminals resisted from base to base and escaped at the last moment. Our losses in first attack, 12 men. And so it went for the first few days, the poorly armed defenders giving ground before the attacks of tanks, flamethrowers, and artillery, but keeping up their resistance. General Stroop could not understand why this trash and subhumanity, as he referred to the besieged Jews, did not give up and submit to being liquidated. Within a few days, he reported, it became apparent that the Jews no longer had any intention to resettle voluntarily, but were determined to resist evacuation. Whereas it had been possible during the first days to catch considerable numbers of Jews, who are cowards by nature, it became more and more difficult during the second half of the operation to capture the bandits and Jews. Over and over again, new battle groups consisting of 20 to 30 Jewish men, accompanied by a corresponding number of women, kindled new resistance. The women belonged to the Chalutzim, Stroop noted, and had the habit, he said, of firing pistols with both hands, and also of unlimbering hand grenades which they concealed in their bloomers. On the fifth day of the battle, an impatient and furious Himmler ordered Stroop to comb out the ghetto with the greatest severity and relentless tenacity. I therefore decided, Stroop related in his final report, to destroy the entire Jewish area by setting every block on fire. He then described what followed. The Jews stayed in the burning buildings until, because of the fear of being burned alive, they jumped down from the upper stories. With their bones broken, they still tried to crawl across the street into buildings which had not yet been set on fire. Despite the danger of being burned alive, the Jews and bandits often preferred to return into the flames rather than risk being caught by us. It was simply incomprehensible to a man of Stroop's stripe that men and women preferred to die in the flames fighting rather than to die peacefully in the gas chambers. For he was shipping off the captured whom he did not slaughter to Treblinka. On April 25th, he sent a teletype to SS headquarters reporting that 27,464 Jews had been captured. "I'm going to try to obtain a train for T2, Treblinka, tomorrow. Otherwise, liquidation will be carried out here tomorrow." Often it was on the spot. The next day, Stroop informed his superiors, 1,330 Jews pulled out of dugouts and immediately destroyed, 362 Jews killed in battle. Only 30 prisoners were evacuated. Toward the end of the rebellion, the defenders took to the sewers. Stroop tried to flush them out by flooding the mains, but the Jews managed to stop the flow of water. One day the Germans dropped smoke bombs into the sewers through 183 manholes, but Stroop ruefully reported that they failed to have the desired results. The final outcome could never be in doubt. For a whole month, the cornered Jews fought with reckless courage, though Stroop, in one daily report, put it differently, complaining about the cunning fighting methods and tricks used by the Jews and bandits. By April 26th, he reported that many of the defenders were going insane from the heat, the smoke, and the explosions. During the day, several more blocks of buildings were burned down. This is the only and final method which forces this trash and subhumanity to the surface. The last day was May 16th. That night, Stroop got off his last daily battle report. 180 Jews, bandits, and subhumans were destroyed. The former Jewish quarter of Warsaw is no longer in existence. The large-scale action was terminated at 2:15 hours by blowing up the Warsaw synagogue. Total number of Jews dealt with, 56,065, including both Jews caught and Jews whose extermination can be proved. A week later, he was asked to explain that figure, and he replied, "Of the total of 56,065 caught, about 7,000 were destroyed in the former ghetto during large-scale operation. 6,929 Jews were destroyed by transporting them to Treblinka. The sum total of Jews destroyed is therefore 13,929. Beyond that, from 5,000 to 6,000 Jews were destroyed by being blown up or by perishing in the flames." General Stroop's arithmetic is not very clear, since this report leaves some 36,000 Jews unaccounted for. But there can be little doubt that he was telling the truth when he wrote in his handsomely bound final report that he had caught a total of 56,065 Jews whose extermination can be proved. The gas chambers no doubt accounted for the 36,000. German losses, according to Stroop, were 16 killed and 90 wounded. Probably the true figures were much higher, given the nature of the savage house-to-house fighting which the general himself described in such lurid detail, but were kept low so as not to disturb Himmler's fine sensibilities. The German troops and police, Stroop concluded, fulfilled their duty indefatigably in faithful comradeship and stood together as exemplary models of soldiers. The final solution went on to the very end of the war. How many Jews did it massacre? The figure has been debated. According to two SS witnesses at Nuremberg, the total was put at between 5 and 6 millions by one of the great Nazi experts on the subject, Karl Eichmann, chief of the Jewish office of the Gestapo, who carried out the final solution under the prodding hand of its originator, Heydrich. Eichmann, according to one of his henchmen, said just before the German collapse that he would leap laughing into the grave because the feeling that he had 5 million people on his conscience would be for him a source of extraordinary satisfaction. Probably he never leaped into the grave, laughing or otherwise. He escaped from an American internment camp in 1945. Note, as this book went on press, the government of Israel announced that it had apprehended Eichmann. The figure given in the Nuremberg indictment was 5,700,000, and it tallied with the calculations of the World Jewish Congress. Reitlinger, in his prodigious study of the final solution, concluded that the figure was somewhat less, between 4,194,200 and 4,581,200. There were some 10 million Jews living in 1939 in the territories occupied by Hitler's forces. By any estimate, it is certain that nearly half of them were exterminated by the Germans. This was the final consequence and the shattering cost of the aberration which came over the Nazi dictator in his youthful gutter days in Vienna, and which he imparted to, or shared with, so many of his German followers. The medical experiments. There were some practices of the Germans during the short-lived New Order that resulted from sheer sadism rather than a lust for mass murder. Perhaps to a psychiatrist there is a difference between the two lusts, though the end result of the first differed from the second only in the scale of deaths. The Nazi medical experiments are an example of this sadism, for in the use of concentration camp inmates and prisoners of war as human guinea pigs, very little, if any, benefit to science was achieved. It is a tale of horror, of which the German medical profession cannot be proud. Although the experiments were conducted by fewer than 200 murderous quacks, albeit some of them held eminent posts in the medical world. Their criminal work was known to thousands of leading physicians of the Reich, not a single one of whom, so far as the record shows, ever uttered the slightest public protest. Not even Germany's most famous surgeon, Dr. Ferdinand Sauerbruch, though he eventually became an anti-Nazi and conspired with the resistance. Sauerbruch sat through a lecture at the Berlin Military Medical Academy in May of 1943, given by two of the most notorious of the doctor killers, Karl Gebhardt and Fritz Fischer, on the subject of gas gangrene experiments on prisoners. Sauerbruch's only argument on this occasion was that surgery was better than sulfanilamide. Professor Gebhardt was sentenced to death at the so-called doctor's trial and hanged on June 2, 1948. Dr. Fischer was given life imprisonment. In the murders in this field, the Jews were not the only victims. The Nazi doctors also used Russian prisoners of war, Polish concentration camp inmates, women as well as men, and even Germans. The experiments were quite varied. Prisoners were placed in pressure chambers and subjected to high-altitude tests until they ceased breathing. They were injected with lethal doses of typhus and jaundice. They were subjected to freezing experiments in icy water or exposed naked in the snow outdoors until they froze to death. Poison bullets were tried out on them, as was mustard gas. At the Ravensbrück concentration camp for women, hundreds of Polish inmates, the rabbit girls they were called, were given gas gangrene wounds while others were subjected to experiments in bone grafting. At Dachau and Buchenwald, gypsies were selected to see how long and in what manner they could live on salt water. Sterilization experiments were carried out on a large scale at several camps by a variety of means on both men and women. For, as an SS physician, Dr. Adolf Pokorny, wrote Himmler on one occasion, "The enemy must be not only conquered but exterminated. If he could not be slaughtered, and the need for slave labor toward the end of the war made that practice questionable, as we have seen, then he could be prevented from propagating." In fact, Dr. Pokorny told Himmler he thought he had found just the right means, the plant Caladium sanguinum, which, he said, induced lasting sterility. The thought alone, the good doctor wrote the SS Führer, that the 3 million Bolsheviks now in German captivity could be sterilized, so that they would be available for work but precluded from propagation, opens up the most far-reaching perspectives. Another German doctor who had far-reaching perspectives was Professor August Hirt, head of the Anatomical Institute of the University of Strasbourg. His special field was somewhat different from those of the others, and he explained it in a letter at Christmas time of 1941 to SS Lieutenant General Rudolf Brandt, Himmler's adjutant. "We have large collections of skulls of almost all races and peoples at our disposal. Of the Jewish race, however, only very few specimens of skulls are available. The war in the East now presents us with the opportunity to overcome this deficiency. By procuring the skulls of the Jewish Bolshevik commissars, who represent the prototype of the repulsive but characteristic subhuman, we have the chance now to obtain scientific material." Professor Hirt did not want the skulls of Jewish Bolshevik commissars already dead. He proposed that the heads of these persons first be measured while they were alive. Then, following the subsequently induced death of the Jew, whose head should not be damaged, the physician will sever the head from the body and will forward it in a hermetically sealed tin can. Whereupon Dr. Hirt would go to work, he promised, on further scientific measurements. Himmler was delighted. He directed that Professor Hirt be supplied with everything needed for his research work. He was well supplied. The actual supplier was an interesting Nazi individual by the name of Wolfram Sievers, who spent considerable time on the witness stand at the main Nuremberg trial and at the subsequent doctor's trial, in the latter of which he was a defendant, and in which he was condemned to death and hanged. Sievers, a former bookseller, had risen to be a colonel of the SS and executive secretary of the Annenherbe, the Institute for Research into Heredity, one of the ridiculous cultural organizations established by Himmler to pursue one of his many lunacies. It had, according to Sievers, 50 research branches, of which one was called the Institute for Military Scientific Research, which Sievers also headed. He was a shifty-eyed, Mephistophelian-looking fellow with a thick, ink-black beard, and at Nuremberg he was dubbed the Nazi Bluebeard after the famous French killer. Like so many other characters in this history, he kept a meticulous diary, and this and his correspondence, both of which survived, contributed to his gallows end. By June 1943, Zevers had collected at Auschwitz the men and women who were to furnish the skeletons for the scientific measurements of Professor Dr. Hirt at the University of Strasbourg. A total of 115 persons, including 79 Jews, 30 Jewesses, 4 Asiatics, and 2 Poles were processed, Zevers reported, requesting the SS main office in Berlin for transportation for them from Auschwitz to the Natzweiler concentration camp near Strasbourg. The British cross-examiner at Nuremberg inquired as to the meaning of processing. Anthropological measurements, Zevers replied. Before they were murdered, they were anthropologically measured. That was all there was to it, was it? And casts were taken, Zevers added. What followed was narrated by SS Captain Josef Kramer, himself a veteran exterminator from Auschwitz, Mauthausen, Dachau, and other camps, and who achieved fleeting fame as the Beast of Belsen, and was condemned to death by a British court at Lüneburg. Professor Hirt of the Strasbourg Anatomical Institute told me of the prisoner convoy en route from Auschwitz. He said these persons were to be killed by poison gas in the gas chamber of the Natzweiler camp, their bodies then to be taken to the Anatomical Institute for his disposal. He gave me a bottle containing about half a pint of salts, I think they were cyanide salts, and told me the approximate dosage I would have to use to poison the arriving inmates from Auschwitz. Early in August 1943, I received 80 inmates who were to be killed with the gas Hirt had given me. One night I went to the gas chamber in a small car with about 15 women this first time. I told the women they had to go into the chamber to be disinfected. I did not tell them, however, that they were to be gassed. By this time, the Nazis had perfected the technique. With the help of a few SS men, Kramer continued, I stripped the women completely and shoved them into the gas chamber when they were stark naked. When the door closed, they began to scream. I introduced a certain amount of salt through a tube and observed through a peephole what happened inside the room. The women breathed for about half a minute before they fell to the floor. After I had turned on the ventilation, I opened the door. I found the women lying lifeless on the floor, and they were covered with excrements. Captain Kramer testified that he repeated the performance until all 80 inmates had been killed and turned the bodies over to Professor Hirt as requested. He was asked by his interrogator what his feelings were at the time, and he gave a memorable answer that gives insight into a phenomenon in the Third Reich that has seemed so elusive of human understanding. I had no feelings in carrying out these things because I had received an order to kill the 80 inmates in the way I already told you. That, by the way, was the way I was trained. Another witness testified as to what happened next. He was Henri Héripierre, a Frenchman who worked in the Anatomical Institute at Strasbourg as Professor Hirt's laboratory assistant until the Allies arrived. The first shipment we received was of the bodies of 30 women. These 30 female bodies arrived still warm. The eyes were wide open and shining. They were red and bloodshot and were popping from their sockets. There were also traces of blood about the nose and mouth. No rigor mortis was evident. Héripierre suspected they had been done to death and secretly copied down their prison numbers, which were tattooed on their left arms. 2 more shipments of 56 men arrived, he said, in exactly the same condition. They were pickled in alcohol under the expert direction of Dr. Hirt. But the professor was a little nervous about the whole thing. Peter, he said to Héripierre, if you can't keep your trap shut, you'll be one of them. Professor Dr. Hirt went about his work nonetheless. According to the correspondence of Zevers, the professor severed the heads and, as he wrote, assembled the skeleton collection which was previously non-existent. But there were difficulties, and after hearing them described by Dr. Hirt, Zevers himself had no expert medical or anatomical knowledge, the chief of the Annenerbe reported them to Himmler on September 5, 1944. In view of the vast amount of scientific research involved, the job of reducing the corpses has not yet been completed. This requires some time for 80 corpses. And time was running out. Advancing American and French troops were nearing Strasbourg. Hirt requested directives as to what should be done with the collection. The corpses can be stripped of the flesh and thereby rendered unidentifiable, Zevers reported to headquarters on behalf of Dr. Hirt. This would mean, however, that at least part of the whole work had been done for nothing, and that this unique collection would be lost to science, since it would be impossible to make plaster casts afterwards. The skeleton collection as such is inconspicuous. The flesh parts could be declared as having been left by the French at the time we took over the Anatomical Institute. Germany had annexed Alsace after the fall of France in 1940, and the Germans had taken over the University of Strasbourg, and would be turned over for cremating. Please advise me which of the following three proposals is to be carried out. 1. The collection as a whole to be preserved. 2. The collection to be dissolved in part. 3. The collection to be completely dissolved. Why were you wanting to deflesh the bodies, witness? The British prosecutor asked in the stillness of the Nuremberg courtroom. Why were you suggesting that the blame should be passed on to the French? As a layman, I could have no opinion in this matter, the Nazi Bluebeard replied. I merely transmitted an inquiry from Professor Hirt. I had nothing to do with the murdering of these people. I simply carried through the function of a mailman. You were the post office, the prosecutor rejoined. Another of these distinguished Nazi post offices, were you? It was a leaky defense offered by many a Nazi at the trials, and on this occasion, as on others, the prosecution nailed it. The captured SS files reveal that on October 26, 1944, Zivas reported that the collection in Strasbourg has been completely dissolved in accordance with the directive. This arrangement is for the best in view of the whole situation. Henri Pierre later described the attempt, not altogether successful, to hide the traces. In September 1944, the Allies made an advance on Belfort, and Professor Hirt ordered Bong and Herr Meyer to cut up these bodies and have them burned in the crematory. I asked Herr Meyer the next day whether he had cut up all the bodies, but Herr Bong replied, "We couldn't cut up all the bodies, it was too much work. We left a few bodies in the storeroom." They were discovered there by an Allied team when units of the U.S. 7th Army, with the French 2nd Armored Division in the lead, entered Strasbourg a month later. Professor Dr. Hirt disappeared. As he left Strasbourg, he was heard boasting that no one would ever take him alive. Apparently no one has, alive or dead. Not only skeletons, but human skins were collected by the masters of the new order, though in the latter case the pretense could not be made that the cause of scientific research was being served. The skins of concentration camp prisoners, especially executed for this ghoulish purpose, had merely decorative value. They made, it was found, excellent lampshades, several of which were expressly fitted up for Frau Ilse Cook, the wife of the commandant of Buchenwald and nicknamed by the inmates the Bitch of Buchenwald. Frau Cook, whose power of life and death over the inmates of Buchenwald was complete, and whose very whim could bring terrible punishment to a prisoner, was sentenced to life imprisonment at the Buchenwald trial, but her sentence was commuted to 4 years and she was soon released. On January 15, 1951, a German court sentenced her to life imprisonment for murder. Her husband was sentenced to death by an SS court during the war for excesses, but was given the option of serving on the Russian front. Before he could do this, however, Prince Waldeck, the leader of the SS in the district, had him executed. Princess Mafalda, daughter of the King and Queen of Italy and wife of Prince Philip of Hesse, was among those who died at Buchenwald. Tattooed skins appeared to have been the most sought after. A German inmate, Andreas Pfaffenberger, deposed at Nuremberg on this. All prisoners with tattooing on them were ordered to report to the dispensary. After the prisoners had been examined, the ones with the best and most artistic specimens were killed by injections. The corpses were then turned over to the pathological department, where the desired pieces of tattooed skin were detached from the bodies and treated further. The finished products were turned over to Koch's wife, who had them fashioned into lampshades and other ornamental household articles. One piece of skin, which apparently struck Frau Koch's fancy, had the words Hansel and Gretel tattooed on it. At another camp, Dachau, the demand for such skins often outran the supply. A Czech physician prisoner, Dr. Frank Blaha, testified at Nuremberg as to that. Sometimes we would not have enough bodies with good skin, and Dr. Rascher would say, "All right, you will get the bodies." The next day we would receive 20 or 30 bodies of young people. They would have been shot in the neck or struck on the head, so that the skin would be uninjured. The skin had to be from healthy prisoners and free from defects. It was this Dr. Zygmunt Rauscher who seems to have been responsible for the more sadistic of the medical experiments in the first place. This horrible quack had attracted the attention of Himmler, among whose obsessions was the breeding of more and more superior Nordic offspring, through reports in SS circles that Frau Rauscher had given birth to 3 children after passing the age of 48, although in truth the Rauschers had simply kidnapped them at suitable intervals from an orphanage. In the spring of 1941, Dr. Rauscher, who was attending a special medical course at Munich given by the Luftwaffe, had a brainstorm. On May 15, 1941, he wrote Himmler about it. He had found, to his horror, that research on the effect of high altitudes on flyers was at a standstill because no tests with human material had yet been possible, as such experiments are very dangerous and nobody volunteers for them. Can you make available 2 or 3 professional criminals for these experiments? The experiments, by which the subjects can, of course, die, would take place with my cooperation. The SS Führer replied within a week that prisoners will, of course, be made available gladly for the high-flight research. They were, and Dr. Rauscher went to work. The results may be seen from his own reports and from those of others, which showed up at Nuremberg and at the subsequent trial of the SS doctors. Dr. Rauscher's own findings are a model of scientific jargon. For the high-altitude tests, he moved the Air Force's decompression chamber at Munich to the nearby Dachau concentration camp, where human guinea pigs were readily available. Air was pumped out of the contraption so that the oxygen and air pressure at high altitudes could be simulated. Dr. Rauscher then made his observations, of which the following one is typical. The third test was without oxygen at the equivalent of 29,400 feet altitude, conducted on a 37-year-old Jew in good general condition. Respiration continued for 30 minutes. After 4 minutes, the TP, test person, began to perspire and roll his head. After 5 minutes, spasms appeared. Between the 6th and 10th minute, respiration increased in frequency, the TP losing consciousness. From the 11th to the 30th minute, respiration slowed down to 3 inhalations per minute, only to cease entirely at the end of that period. About half an hour after breathing had ceased, an autopsy was begun. An Austrian inmate, Anton Pakoleg, who worked in Dr. Rauscher's office, has described the experiments less scientifically. I have personally seen through the observation window of the decompression chamber when a prisoner inside would stand a vacuum until his lungs ruptured. They would go mad and pull out their hair in an effort to relieve the pressure. They would tear their heads and face with their fingers and nails in an attempt to maim themselves in their madness. They would beat on the walls with their hands and head and scream in an effort to relieve pressure on their eardrums. These cases usually ended in the death of the subject. Some 200 prisoners were subjected to this experiment before Dr. Rauscher was finished with it. Of these, according to the testimony at the doctor's trial, about 80 were killed outright and the remainder executed somewhat later so that no tales would be told. This particular research project was finished in May 1942, at which time Field Marshal Erhard Milk of the Luftwaffe conveyed Goering's thanks to Himmler for Dr. Rauscher's pioneer experiments. A little later, on October 10, 1942, Lieutenant General Dr. Hipke, medical inspector of the Air Force, tendered to Himmler, in the name of German aviation medicine and research, his obedient gratitude for the Dachau experiments. However, he thought there was one omission in them. They had not taken into account the extreme cold which an aviator faces at high altitudes. To rectify this omission, the Luftwaffe, he informed Himmler, was building a decompression chamber equipped with full refrigeration and with a nominal altitude of 100,000 feet. Freezing experiments, he added, along different lines are still underway at Dachau. Indeed they were, and again Dr. Rauscher was in the vanguard. But some of his doctor colleagues were having qualms. Was it Christian to do what Dr. Rauscher was doing? Apparently a few German Luftwaffe medics were beginning to have their doubts. When Himmler heard of this, he was infuriated and promptly wrote Field Marshal Milk protesting about the difficulties caused by Christian medical circles in the Air Force. He begged the Luftwaffe Chief of Staff to release Rauscher from the Air Force Medical Corps so that he could be transferred to the SS. He suggested that they find a non-Christian physician who should be honorable as a scientist, to pass on Dr. Rauscher's valuable works. In the meantime, Himmler emphasized that he personally assumed the responsibility for supplying asocial individuals and criminals who deserve only to die from concentration camps for these experiments. Dr. Rascher's freezing experiments were of two kinds. First, to see how much cold a human being could endure before he died, and second, to find the best means of rewarming a person who still lived after being exposed to extreme cold. Two methods were selected to freeze a man: dumping him into a tank of ice water, or leaving him out in the snow, completely naked, overnight during winter. Dr. Rascher's reports to Himmler on his freezing and warming experiments are voluminous. An example or two will give the tenor. One of the earliest ones was made on September 10, 1942. The TPs were immersed in water in full flying uniform, with hood. A life jacket prevented sinking. The experiments were conducted at water temperatures between 36.5 and 53.5 degrees Fahrenheit. In the first test series, the back of the head and the brain stem were above water. In another series, the back of the neck and cerebellum were submerged. Temperatures as low as 79.5 in the stomach and 79.7 in the rectum were recorded electrically. Fatalities occurred only when the medulla and the cerebellum were chilled. In autopsies of such fatalities, large quantities of free blood, up to a pint, were always found inside the cranial cavity. The heart regularly showed extreme distension of the right chamber. The TPs in such tests inevitably died when body temperature had declined to 82.5, despite all rescue attempts. These autopsy findings plainly prove the importance of a heated head and neck protector for the foam suit now in the process of development. A table which Dr. Rascher appended covers six fatal cases and shows the water temperatures, body temperature on removal from water, body temperature at death, the length of stay in the water, and the time it took the patient to die. The toughest man endured in the ice water for 100 minutes, the weakest for 53 minutes. Walter Neff, a camp inmate who served as Dr. Rascher's medical orderly, furnished the doctor's trial with a layman's description of one water-freezing test. It was the worst experiment ever made. Two Russian officers were brought from the prison barracks. Rascher had them stripped, and they had to go into the vat naked. Hour after hour went by, and whereas usually unconsciousness from the cold set in after 60 minutes at the latest, the two men in this case still responded fully after 2.5 hours. All appeals to Rascher to put them to sleep by injection were fruitless. About the third hour, one of the Russians said to the other, "Comrade, please tell the officer to shoot us." The other replied that he expected no mercy from this fascist dog. The two shook hands with a "farewell, comrade." These words were translated to Rascher by a young Pole, though in a somewhat different form. Rascher went to his office. The young Pole at once tried to chloroform the two victims, but Rascher came back at once, threatening us with his gun. The test lasted at least 5 hours before death supervened. The nominal chief of the initial cold water experiments was a certain Dr. Holzlerner, professor of medicine at the University of Kiel, assisted by a Dr. Finke, and after working with Rascher for a couple of months, they believed that they had exhausted the experimental possibilities. The three physicians thereupon drew up a 32-page top-secret report to the Air Force entitled "Freezing Experiments with Human Beings," and called a meeting of German scientists at Nuremberg for October 26th to 27th, 1942, to hear and discuss their findings. The subject of the meeting was "Medical Questions in Marine and Winter Emergencies." According to the testimony at the doctor's trial, 95 German scientists, including some of the most eminent men in the field, participated, and though the three doctors left no doubt that a good many human beings had been done to death in the experiments, there were no questions put as to this and no protests therefore made. Professor Holzlerner and Dr. Finke bowed out of the experiments at this time, but the persevering Dr. Rascher carried on alone from October 1942 until May of the following year. Professor Holzlerner may have had a guilty conscience. Picked up by the British, he committed suicide after his first interrogation. Rascher wanted, among other things, to pursue experiments in what he called dry freezing. Auschwitz, he wrote to Himmler, is much better suited for such tests than Dachau because it is colder there and because the size of the grounds causes less of a stir in the camp. The test persons yell when they freeze. For some reason, the change of locality could not be arranged, so Dr. Roscher went ahead with his studies at Dachau, praying for some real winter weather. "Thank God we have had another intense cold snap at Dachau," he wrote Himmler in the early spring of 1943. "Some people remained out in the open for 14 hours at 21 degrees, attaining an interior temperature of 77 degrees with peripheral frostbite." At the doctor's trial, the witness Neff again provided a layman's description of the dry freezing experiments of his chief. "A prisoner was placed naked on a stretcher outside the barracks in the evening. He was covered with a sheet, and every hour a bucket of cold water was poured over him. The test person lay out in the open like this into the morning. Their temperatures were taken. Later, Dr. Roscher said it was a mistake to cover the subject with a sheet and to drench him with water. In the future, test persons must not be covered. The next experiment was a test on 10 prisoners who were exposed in turn, likewise naked." As the prisoners slowly froze, Dr. Roscher or his assistant would record temperatures, heart action, respiration, and so on. The cries of the suffering often rent the night. "Initially," Neff explained to the court, "Roscher forbade these tests to be made in a state of anesthesia. But the test persons made such a racket that it was impossible for Roscher to continue these tests without anesthetic." The TPs, test persons, were left to die, as Himmler said they deserved to, in the ice water tanks or lying naked on the ground outside the barracks at Dachau on a winter evening. If they survived, they were shortly exterminated. But the brave German flyers and sailors, for whose benefit the experiments were ostensibly carried out, and who might find themselves ditched in the icy waters of the Arctic Ocean, or marooned in some frozen waste above the Arctic Circle in Norway, Finland, or northern Russia, had to be saved, if possible. The inimitable Dr. Roscher therefore took to performing on his human guinea pigs at Dachau what he termed warming experiments. What was the best method, he wanted to know, for warming a frozen man and thus possibly saving his life? Heinrich Himmler, never backward in offering practical solutions to his corps of busy scientists, suggested to Roscher that warming by animal heat be tried. But at first the doctor did not think much of the idea. "Warming by animal heat, the bodies of animals or women, is much too slow," he wrote the SS chief. But Himmler kept after him. "I am very curious," he wrote Roscher, "about the experiments with animal heat. Personally, I believe these experiments may bring the best and the most sustained results." Though skeptical, Dr. Roscher was not the man to ignore a suggestion from the leader of the SS. He promptly embarked on a series of the most grotesque experiments of all, recording them for posterity in every morbid detail. 4 inmates from the women's concentration camps at Ravensbrück were sent to him at Dachau. However, there was something about one of them, they were classified as prostitutes, that disturbed the doctor, and he so reported to his superiors. One of the women assigned showed impeccably Nordic racial characteristics. I asked the girl why she had volunteered for brothel service, and she replied, "to get out of the concentration camp." When I objected that it was shameful to volunteer as a brothel girl, I was advised, "better half a year in a brothel than half a year in a concentration camp." "My racial conscience is outraged by the prospect of exposing to racially inferior concentration camp elements a girl who is outwardly pure Nordic. For this reason, I decline to use this girl for my experimental purposes." But he used others whose hair was less fair and the eyes less blue. His findings were duly reported to Himmler in a report marked "Secret" on February 12, 1942. The test persons were chilled in the familiar way, dressed or undressed, in cold water at various temperatures. Removal from the water took place at a rectal temperature of 86 degrees. In 8 cases, the test persons were placed between 2 naked women on a wide bed. The women were instructed to snuggle up to the chilled person as closely as possible. The 3 persons were then covered with blankets. Once the test persons regained consciousness, they never lost it again, quickly grasping their situation and nestling close to the naked bodies of the women. The rise of body temperature then proceeded at approximately the same speed as with test persons warmed by being swathed in blankets. An exception was formed by 4 test persons who practiced sexual intercourse between 86 and 89.5 degrees. In these persons, after coitus, a very swift temperature rise ensued, comparable to that achieved by means of a hot water bath. Dr. Rosher found, somewhat to his surprise, that one woman warmed a frozen man faster than two women. I attribute this to the fact that in warming by means of one woman, personal inhibitions are avoided and the woman clings more closely to the chilled person. Here, too, return of full consciousness was notably rapid. In the case of only one person did consciousness fail to return, and only a slight degree of warming was recorded. The test person died with symptoms of a brain hemorrhage, later confirmed by autopsy. Summing up, this murderous hack concluded that warming up a chilled man with women proceeds very slowly, and that hot baths were more efficacious. Only test persons, he concluded, whose physical state permitted sexual intercourse warmed up surprisingly fast, and also showed a surprisingly rapid return of full bodily well-being. According to the testimony at the doctor's trial, some 400 freezing experiments were performed on 300 persons, of whom between 80 and 90 died directly as a result thereof, and the rest, except for a few, were bumped off subsequently, some of them having been driven insane. Dr. Rosher himself, incidentally, was not around to testify at this trial. He continued his bloody labors on various new projects, too numerous to mention, until May 1944, when he and his wife were arrested by the SS. Not for his murderous experiments, it seems, but on the charge that he and his wife had practiced deceit about how their children came into the world. Such treachery Himmler, with his worship of German mothers, could not brook. He had sincerely believed that Frau Rosher had begun to bear her three children at the age of 48, and he was outraged when he learned that she had kidnapped them. So Dr. Rosher was incarcerated in the political bunker at his familiar Dachau camp, and his wife was carted off to Ravensbrück, from which the doctor had procured his prostitutes for the warming tests. Neither survived, and it is believed that Himmler himself, in one of the last acts of his life, ordered their execution. They might have made awkward witnesses. A number of such awkward witnesses did survive to stand trial. Seven of them were condemned to death and hanged, defending their lethal experiments to the last as patriotic acts which served the fatherland. Dr. Hertha Oberhäuser, the only woman defendant at the doctor's trial, was given 20 years. She had admitted giving lethal injections to 5 or 6 Polish women among the hundreds who suffered the tortures of the damned in a variety of experiments at Ravensbrück. A number of doctors, such as the notorious Pokorny, who had wanted to sterilize millions of the enemy, were acquitted. A few were contrite. At a second trial of medical underlings, Dr. Edwin Katzenellenbogen, a former member of the faculty of the Harvard Medical School, asked the court for the death sentence. "You have placed the mark of Cain on my forehead," he exclaimed. "Any physician who committed the crimes I am charged with deserves to be killed." He was given life imprisonment. The death of Heydrich and the end of Lidice. Midway through the war, there was one act of retribution against the gangster masters of the New Order for their slaughtering of the conquered people. Reinhard Heydrich, chief of the security police and the SD, deputy chief of the Gestapo, this long-nosed, icy-eyed, 38-year-old policeman of diabolical cast, the genius of the final solution, Hangman Heydrich, as he became known in the occupied lands, met a violent end. Restless for further power and secretly intriguing to oust his chief, Himmler, he had got himself appointed, in addition to his other offices, acting protector of Bohemia and Moravia. Poor old Neurath, the protector, was packed off on indefinite sick leave by Hitler in September 1941, and Heydrich replaced him in the ancient seat of the Bohemian kings at Hradčin Castle in Prague. But not for long. On the morning of May 29, 1942, as he was driving in his open Mercedes sports car from his country villa to the castle in Prague, a bomb of British make was tossed at him, blowing the car to pieces and shattering his spine. It had been hurled by two Czechs, Jan Kubis and Josef Gabek, of the Free Czechoslovak Army in England, who had been parachuted from an RAF plane. Well equipped for their assignment, they got away under a smoke screen and were given refuge by the priests of the Karl Borromeus Church in Prague. Heydrich expired of his wounds on June 4th, and a veritable hecatomb followed as the Germans took savage revenge, after the manner of the old Teutonic rites, for the death of their hero. According to one Gestapo report, 1,331 Czechs, including 201 women, were immediately executed. The actual assassins, along with 120 members of the Czech resistance, who were hiding in the Karl Borromeus Church, were besieged there by the SS and killed to the last man. According to Schellenberg, who was there, the Gestapo never learned that the actual assassins were among the dead in the church. Schellenberg, The Labyrinth, page 292. It was the Jews, however, who suffered the most for this act of defiance against the master race. 3,000 of them were removed from the privileged ghetto of Theresienstadt and shipped to the east for extermination. On the day of the bombing, Goebbels had 500 of the few remaining Jews at large in Berlin arrested, and on the day of Heydrich's death, 152 of them were executed as a reprisal. But of all the consequences of Heydrich's death, the fate of the little village of Lidice near the mining town of Kladno, not far from Prague, will perhaps be longest remembered by the civilized world. For no other reason except to serve as an example to a conquered people who dared to take the life of one of their inquisitors, a terrible savagery was carried out in this peaceful little rural place. On the morning of June 9, 1942, 10 truckloads of German security police under the command of Captain Max Rostock, hanged in Prague in August 1951, arrived at Lidice and surrounded the village. No one was allowed to leave, though anyone who lived there and happened to be away could return. A boy of 12, panicking, tried to steal away. He was shot down and killed. A peasant woman ran toward the outlying fields. She was shot in the back and killed. The entire male population of the village was locked up in the barns, stables, and cellar of a farmer named Horak, who was also the mayor. The next day, from dawn until 4 p.m., they were taken into the garden behind the barn in batches of 10 and shot by firing squads of the security police. A total of 172 men and boys over 16 were executed there. An additional 19 male residents who were working in the Kladno mines during the massacre were later picked up and dispatched in Prague. 7 women who were rounded up at Lidice were taken to Prague and shot. All the rest of the women of the village, who numbered 195, were transported to the Ravensbrück concentration camp in Germany, where 7 were gassed, 3 disappeared, and 42 died of ill treatment. 4 of the Lidice women who were about to give birth were first taken to a maternity hospital in Prague, where their newly born infants were murdered, and they themselves then shipped to Ravensbrück. There remained for the Germans the disposal of the children of Lidice, whose fathers were now dead, whose mothers were imprisoned. It must be said that the Germans did not shoot them too, not even the male children. They were carted off to a concentration camp at Gneisenau. There were 90 in all, and from these, 7, who were less than a year old, were selected by the Nazis, after a suitable examination by Himmler's racial experts, to be sent to Germany to be brought up as Germans under German names. Later, the others were similarly disposed of. Every trace of them has been lost, the Czechoslovak government, which filed an official report on Lidice for the Nuremberg Tribunal, concluded. Happily, some of them at least were later found. I remember in the autumn of 1945 reading the pitiful appeals in the then-Allied-controlled German newspapers from the surviving mothers of Lidice, asking the German people to help them locate their children and send them home. UNRWA reported on April 2, 1947, that 17 of them had been found in Bavaria and sent back to their mothers in Czechoslovakia. Actually, Lidice itself had been wiped off the face of the earth. As soon as the men had been massacred and the women and children carted off, the security police had burned down the village, dynamited the ruins, and leveled it off. Lidice, though it became the most widely known example of Nazi savagery of this kind, was not the only village in the German-occupied lands to suffer such a barbaric end. There was one other in Czechoslovakia, Lajaki, and several more in Poland, Russia, Greece, and Yugoslavia. Even in the West, where the new order was relatively less murderous, the example of Lidice was repeated by the Germans, though in most cases, such as that of Televag in Norway, the men, women, and children were merely deported to separate concentration camps after every building in the village had been razed to the ground. But on June 10, 1944, 2 years to a day after the massacre of Lidice, A terrible toll of life was taken at the French village of Oradour-sur-Glane, near Limoges. A detachment of the SS division Das Reich, which had already earned a reputation for terror, if not for fighting, in Russia, surrounded the French town and ordered the inhabitants to gather in the central square. There the people were told by the commandant that explosives were reported to have been hidden in the village, and that a search and the checking of identity cards would be made, whereupon the entire population of 652 persons was locked up. The men were herded into barns, the women and children into the church. The entire village was then set on fire. The German soldiers next set upon the inhabitants. The men in the barns who were not burned to death were machine-gunned and killed. The women and children in the church were also peppered with machine-gun fire, and those who were not killed were burned to death when the German soldiers set fire to the church. 3 days later, the Bishop of Limoges found the charred bodies of 15 children in a heap behind the burned-out altar. 9 years later, in 1953, a French military court established that 642 inhabitants, 245 women, 207 children, and 190 men had perished in the massacre at Oradour. 10 survived. Though badly burned, they had simulated death and thus escaped it. 20 members of the SS detachment were sentenced to death by this court, but only 2 were executed, the remaining 18 having their sentences commuted to prison terms of from 5 to 12 years. The commander of the Das Reich division, SS Lieutenant General Heinz Lammerding, was condemned to death in absentia. So far as I know, he was never found. The actual commander of the detachment at Oradour, Major Otto Dickmann, was killed in action in Normandy a few days later. Oradour, like Lidice, was never rebuilt. Its ruins remain a monument to Hitler's new order in Europe. The gutted church stands out against the peaceful countryside as a reminder of the beautiful June day, just before the harvest, when the village and its inhabitants suddenly ceased to exist. Where once a window stood is a little sign. Madame Ruffons, the only survivor from the church, escaped through this window. In front there is a small figure of Christ affixed to a rusty iron cross. Such as has been sketched in this chapter were the beginnings of Hitler's new order. Such was the debut of the Nazi gangster empire in Europe. Fortunately for mankind, it was destroyed in its infancy. Not by any revolt of the German people against such a reversion to barbarism, but by the defeat of German arms and the consequent fall of the Third Reich, the story of which now remains to be told. Chapter 28. The Fall of Mussolini. For 3 successive war years when summer came, it had been the Germans who had launched the great offensives on the continent of Europe. Now, in 1943, the tables turned. With the capture in early May of that year of the Axis forces in Tunisia, all that remained of a once mighty army in North Africa, it was obvious that General Eisenhower's Anglo-American armies would next turn on Italy itself. This was the kind of nightmare which had haunted Mussolini in September of 1939, and which had made him delay Italy's entry into the war until neighboring France had been conquered by the Germans and the British Expeditionary Force driven across the Channel. The nightmare now returned, but this time it was rapidly turning into reality. Mussolini himself was ill and disillusioned, and he was frightened. Defeatism was rife among his people and in the armed forces. There had been mass strikes in the industrial cities of Milan and Turin, where the hungry workers had demonstrated for bread, peace, and freedom. The discredited and corrupt fascist regime itself was fast crumbling, and when Count Ciano at the beginning of the year was relieved as foreign minister and sent to the Vatican as ambassador, the Germans suspected that he had gone there to try to negotiate a separate peace with the Allies, as Antonescu, the Romanian dictator, was already urging. For several months, Mussolini had been bombarding Hitler with appeals to make peace with Stalin, so that his armies could be withdrawn to the west to make a common defense with the Italians against the growing threat of the Anglo-American forces in the Mediterranean and of those which he believed were assembling in England for a cross-channel invasion. The time had come again, Hitler realized, for a meeting with Mussolini in order to buck up his sagging partner and to put him straight. This was arranged for April 7, 1943, at Salzburg, and though the Duce arrived determined to have his way, or at least his say, at last, he once more succumbed to the Führer's torrents of words. Hitler later described his success to Goebbels, who jotted it down in his diary. By putting every ounce of energy into the effort, he succeeded in pushing Mussolini back on the rails. The Duce underwent a complete change. When he got out of the train on his arrival, the Führer thought, he looked like a broken old man. When he left, after 4 days, he was in high fettle, ready for any deed. But in point of fact, Mussolini was not ready for the events which now followed in quick succession. The Allied conquest of Tunisia in May was followed by the successful Anglo-American landings in Sicily on July 10th. The Italians had little stomach for battle in their own homeland. Reports soon reached Hitler that the Italian army was in a state of collapse, as he put it to his advisers at OKW. Only barbaric measures, Hitler told a war council on July 17th, like those applied by Stalin in 1941 or by the French in 1917, can help to save the nation. A sort of tribunal or court-martial should be set up in Italy to remove undesirable elements. Once again, he summoned Mussolini to discuss the matter, the meeting taking place on July 19th at Feltre in northern Italy. This, incidentally, was the 13th conference of the two dictators, and it followed the pattern of the most recent ones. Hitler did all the talking, Mussolini all the listening, for 3 hours before lunch and for 2 hours after it. Without much success, the fanatical German leader tried to rekindle the sunken spirits of his ailing friend and ally. They must continue the fight on all fronts. Their tasks could not be left to another generation. The voice of history was still beckoning them. Sicily and Italy proper could be held if the Italians fought. There would be more German reinforcements to help them. A new U-boat would soon be in operation and would deal the British a Stalingrad. Despite Hitler's promises and boasts, the atmosphere, Dr. Schmidt found, was most depressing. Mussolini was so overwrought that he could no longer follow his friend's tirades, and at the end asked Schmidt to furnish him with his notes. The Duce's despair worsened when, during the meeting, reports came in of the first heavy daylight Allied air attack on Rome. Benito Mussolini, tired and senile, though he was only going on 60, he who had strutted so arrogantly across Europe's stage for 2 decades, was at the end of his rope. When he returned to Rome, he found much worse than the aftermath of the first heavy bombing. He faced revolt from some of his closest henchmen in the fascist party hierarchy, even from his son-in-law, Ciano. And behind it there was a plot among a wider circle that reached to the king to overthrow him. The rebellious fascist leaders, led by Dino Grandi, Giuseppe Bottai, and Ciano, demanded the convocation of the fascist Grand Council, which had not met since December 1939, and which had always been a rubber stamp body completely dominated by the Duce. It convened on the night of July 24th to 25th, 1943, and Mussolini, for the first time in his career as dictator, found himself the target of violent criticism for the disaster into which he had led the country. By a vote of 19-8, a resolution was carried demanding the restoration of a constitutional monarchy with a democratic parliament. It also called for the full command of the armed forces to be restored to the king. The fascist rebels, with the possible exception of Grandi, do not appear to have had any idea of going further than this. But there was a second and wider plot of certain generals and the king, which was now sprung. Mussolini himself apparently felt that he had weathered the storm. After all, decisions in Italy were not made by a majority vote in the Grand Council, but by the Duce. And he was taken completely by surprise when on the evening of July 25th he was summoned to the royal palace by the king, summarily dismissed from office and carted off under arrest in an ambulance to a police station. "I was completely free of any forebodings," Mussolini wrote later in describing his state of mind as he set out for the palace. King Victor Emmanuel lost no time in bringing him down to earth. "My dear Duce," Mussolini quotes him as saying at the outset, "it's no longer any good. Italy has gone to bits. The soldiers don't want to fight anymore. At this moment you are the most hated man in Italy." "You are making an extremely grave decision," Mussolini says he replied. But even by his own account, he made little attempt to induce the monarch to change his mind. He ended by wishing luck to his successor. Mussolini, Memoirs 1942-1943, pages 80-81. So fell ignominiously the modern Roman Caesar, a bellicose-sounding man of the 20th century who had known how to profit from its confusions and despair, but who underneath the gaudy facade was made largely of sawdust. As a person he was not unintelligent. He had read widely in history and thought he understood its lessons. But as dictator he had made the fatal mistake of seeking to make a martial imperial great power,